This is the Owens Recovery Science Podcast.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to another Owens Recovery Science Podcast. This is it's a somber day because it's our first podcast without our leader, our president of operations, the C. I don't know. He's got C in front of his name somewhere, I'm sure, right? Johnny is unable to join us. He's we're sending up prayers because he is recovering from a trip to Mexico, where we just learned today that Zach had no idea what Montezuma's Revenge is when Johnny told us he had Montezuma's Revenge. Zach, did you Google that? Did you Google Montezuma's Revenge to see?
No, I still haven't, but like, yeah, this is what
you
I would say.
You piece things together from Johnny's text messages.
I kind of got that.
And the general idea.
I still struggle to understand why people find the desire and the need to leave the country. Tell you, I spent weeks in the wilderness drinking straight out of streams, no filtering needed, and I've never had this issue. So, I mean,
they don't build them like they don't build Marines like they used to.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that it's the choices where we decide to vacation, and sometimes you have to pay the consequences.
Well, you know, some of us have to bring our families along, Zach. So, you know, we have different choices than going and taking a backpack and a bow and spending a few days in the wilderness in Montana.
Well,
So
you got to negotiate these things up front, Ben. That's Zach has. You know,
Kyle, it's exactly what I was going to say. We all make decisions, and
Kyle, you started that intro for the podcast as if, you know, Johnny was in a horrific accident and we needed to really take some time to give him our thoughts. Johnny's okay, everybody. He's just a little low on fluids and body weight at the moment. So
we heard he's getting a Scotch tape test today. is what we heard. So you guys, you should Google that one.
You know, the other thing that I would say is one of the tricks you can do is you just drink the IV bags. Don't worry about getting
put it into the vein.
You don't have to put it in the vein. You just straight up drink it. It personally tastes like ocean water, but does the trick pretty good.
Isn't going into the vein more efficient, Zach?
Well, sometimes like you just don't want to deal with that. You know, maybe you have an aversion to needles. Maybe there's a reason why you don't want to get stuck. And
I feel like there's got to be a story here.
you just straight up.
There's some like sofa getting lit on fire, military party story behind this right here. I know all these stories go with Zach.
Zach just refills his Franzia wine bags with IV fluid so he can, you know, drink that afterward.
Yeah.
Well, I thought Johnny was skipping out since this is our first video podcast. Did I tell you guys that we're doing video now?
No.
Oh, weird. I'm so sorry. My bad. Probably shouldn't have told y'all that. I'm kidding. It's not really for those people that are going to hunt around looking for the video podcast. It's not actually a video podcast. I am wearing my Fuel Hunt hoodie sweatshirt from JJ Thomas. Thank you. Shout out Primal Physical Therapy in Philly. Or it's not actually Philly. What is it? It's got some weird name.
It's called Bryn Mawr.
Bryn Mawr. Yeah.
Yeah. Just on the northeast side there, but right by Villanova.
Okay. Nice. Yeah,
that's where the company's at too. Fuel Hunt.
I'm not familiar with the Fuel Hunt company, but I like the swag. It's cool.
They put out some good stuff on Instagram, motivational stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's what they're motivational people.
Yeah,
I will check them out. Well, gentlemen, welcome back. It's good to have you. It's been a minute. We We always say we're going to do more of these and frequently and then fail miserably. So this is us saying we'll try to do more of these podcasts more frequently, and we'll see if that actually happens. So I'm going to talk about a couple papers today, both using endurance exercise. One was kind of interesting, we thought, because they sort of used RPE as a way of dosing exercise. Another was kind of cool because they looked at high and low volume. And so we've kind of thought maybe taking the two papers and sort of discussing them in parallel would help us kind of extrapolate, if you will, how our listeners might kind of use this information. So the first paper is got some folks, Brennan Scott, down at, he's at Murdoch, right, in Australia, I believe. And yep. Then Dr. Smith is kind of the lead author there. And that paper is titled A Comparison of Physiological and Perceptual Responses to Fixed Power and Perceptually Regulated Cycling with and Without Blood Flow Restriction. And then this last piece, in trained cyclists, is a pretty important piece there, I would say, because not often do we get studies on trained individuals. And so sometimes that can kind of muddy those results, you know, where now at least we can sort of assume that all of these folks are, you know, similarly trained as somewhat homogenous groups. So that's always nice to know. And the second paper we're going to talk about is out of Dr. Burr's lab up at the University of Guelph. This came out in 2023. The Smith paper just came out literally like about 6 weeks ago, I think. Dr. Burr's paper, low and high volume blood flow restriction treadmill walking, both improve maximal aerobic capacity independently of blood volume. So I think we were going to talk about, we kind of talked about maybe hitting the Smith paper first, the one where they were breaking down based on power and RPE. Ben, you want to maybe describe what they did here and kind of tell our listeners what's shaking?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, as you mentioned already, they had some trained cyclists. There were 12 people included in the study. They had them come in on different days and essentially created four different conditions. They did a fixed power cycling session first because they essentially said that they've got to do the fixed power first so they can use that as a way to create an RPE-based model for the exercise. And so the training session itself was 10 minutes of cycling, and they trained at the first ventilatory threshold from a VO2 max, you know, test that they had already done on the bike. So that fixed power training model basically came out to around 220 watts, which is a pretty good power to maintain for 10 minutes. It's probably going to give you some stress, even for somebody that's trained. And then they had another session where they did that same fixed power with BFR added. So they were trying to maintain that 220 watts while cycling with BFR. And they used a fairly narrow cuff. It was a 5 centimeter wide cuff. And they were targeting 60% LOP from what I understand. But they used a Linicky equation to calculate LOP as opposed to actually measuring it, because kind of similar to what we've seen in other papers, if you're using a really narrow cuff, like 5 centimeters wide, you can't really get an LOP measure unless you go to a really high pressure. And in some studies, they've gone up to 500 millimeters of mercury and you still can't get it. So you're kind of left with using an equation model if you're going to try and estimate it, which we have some opinions may or may not be the best way to do it, but it's the same for both of the BFR conditions in this paper. So the two other conditions was they had a fixed RPE. So when they're doing this 10 minutes of cycling with the fixed power, the first session, every 2 minutes, they're telling you how hard they think it is, and they're giving you an RPE for that. And so for this fixed RPE, they said, okay, you can adjust your power, but try and keep it similar to how it felt for the fixed power cycling session. And then you have that same idea, but with BFR. So again, you can adjust your power and adjust what you're doing on the bike as long as it feels the same as what you were doing as far as your RPE from that initial fixed power session. So they said every session has to be separated by at least 24 hours. I don't know that I saw exactly how far apart the sessions were actually done, but I would think personally for some of this, you might want more than that 24 hours between. They looked at a lot of things. They measured lactate. They looked at heart rate, respiratory rate, VO2, RPE, cuff discomfort, pain, and as we might expect, you know, the highest heart rate, respiratory rate, and lactate and RPE and cuff pain were at the fixed power with BFR, because it would seem like that would be the hardest session to get through. And whenever they, you know, let people regulate their own power with the BFR added, it seemed like they were able to get a lot of the similar, you know, changes physiologically while working at a lower power. And essentially they were able to regulate it to where it did feel very similar, but they did less overall work and potentially estimated a similar training session by regulating it themselves. I feel like I've missed some things. Maybe y'all can fill in some gaps there.
Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, I think we probably all do this, but, you know, we look at a paper and we kind of look at the methods a little bit and we kind of go, okay, all right, I know at least a little bit of what they're probably going to find here. So, like, when you looked at these methods, Zach, you know, what did you just immediately say, all right, I know that we're probably going to see this, 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 and this? Like, what were your kind of initial thoughts when you were?
Yeah, I think you look at it, right, and you're like, if you're going to base things off of RPE and then you try to objectively measure that, or it's like, say, how hard ultimately was this? And then what you see is power drops off within the within that BFR group. And so just to kind of bring that back to what Ben was saying, we have these groups. What basically we're going to cycle at a fixed power, or we're going to cycle at an RPE that is going to be increased every 2 minutes throughout that 10-minute period. That's based off that initial control power test.
So if you're going at a fixed power, that means a certain level of resistance at a certain pace.
That's right. And they had
from the bike, and that has to stay.
That's right.
The goal for the subject is keep that constant, right?
Yeah.
And now we're adding BFR to that.
So the fixed power with the BFR group, I think Ben said, was at 220 watts. That is yeah, it's going to be pretty tough. I mean, you're definitely going to get into that. And they talk about that later on in the paper. But the group that's cycling at that at the RPE, what they found was the power dropped off by roughly 13% as they continued on. And there was a significant drop in power as they tried to maintain these RPEs, incremental increases throughout the 10 minutes. So you would suspect to see that just because the tourniquet is going to induce some fatigue. By inducing fatigue, you're not going to be able to generate the same amount of power. So that was the one. And then I think when you look at it from the context of the group that's cycling out of peak power, you're thinking like, okay, so these people with the cuff, we would suspect that they're going to work harder to maintain that peak or that power that they're training at, like the first ventilatory threshold. And that's really kind of what the results ultimately showed. When you look at heart rate, respiration rate, lactate levels, they were the highest in the group that cycled with the tourniquet or the condition with the tourniquet on at the peak power or at that constant power, I should say, 220-ish watts.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things that I think, you know, this makes me consider is also to use this model of, you know, basing exercise off of an RPE and have it be somewhat consistent. You would need a fairly trained population like this, you know, people that are very familiar with exercise discomfort. So that way they can give you a realistic estimation of how hard that exercise session is. And, you know, they have an expectation going in that the bike should feel pretty uncomfortable. And as I go deeper into this, we should have a graded discomfort that comes with maintaining this level of work. You know, whereas if you tried to use the same model on somebody that's less trained, I think you're going to have a lot more variability in what that exercise session is going to look like. So maybe that
Yeah, I
helps.
told. I mean, I think obviously, right? I mean, I think we see that with any of these sort of rep max estimators, RPE scales, etc. The more trained, more familiar an individual is, the more accurate those measures you get. But I think sometimes we make those comments, and the unfortunate thing that happens is people might hear, "Well, I shouldn't use that then because it's not as
No.
accurate," and that's not what I would be saying here. I might say, "Hey, look, hop on the bike. I want you to pedal, and you tell me, I would like you to get to this RPE of, let's just say it's four. I'd like you to get to an RPE of four. Here's what RPE is." You kind of explain it to them and sort of anchor it so they sort of know like how to guess it. And then once they pick, okay, I'm at a four. Well, now you have objective measures. You have revolutions per minute. You know how much resistance is there in a bike, right? And so now we can just start working, into fatigue, if you will, right? So, you've kind of self-selected a workload intensity, if you will. And now I'm going to use what you selected to kind of make you tired and keep sort of progressing. And then, the other thing that's going to happen over time is, as you work with that person, they're going to get better at doing RPE, and they're going to be more and more accurate with how they're sort of self-dosing, if you will. So,
Yeah. Well, and their benchmark is going to change, right? I mean, that's the other thing that we
yeah,
know
they're going
about
to
that
change.
repeated bout effect. And, you know, the other thing that I didn't mention when going over the study
Their
is that
benchmark
one.
is going to change. A little too wordy. Dumb it down for me, Ben. I think what you're saying is, they're going to get kind of used to discomfort, so they're not going to perceive the discomfort as great, which is something that Lenicky showed when he tried to do the, and why we kind
Yeah,
of get
the
so
estimated
irritated when
tightness
people
thing.
start talking
Yeah.
about RPE and tightness of a band. It's like, well,
Yeah.
yeah, but Jeremy also showed that if you just do it a second time, people almost get to full occlusion and they call it seven. So
Right.
yeah, so lots of
Yeah.
things are kind of changing, but in the end, you're kind of refining and getting more and more accurate over time.
Right.
I think one thing to just kind of back up, to the very beginning of the methods is talking about how they actually determined the RPE, right? Because they base it off a VO2 test. And it was an incremental power test is what they used. And so,
What does that mean,
with
Zach?
that,
What does that mean?
so what they'll do is you'll start cycling at a constant power, a constant power output. They initially started at 50 watts. So you cycle, you're generating 50 watts, and the goal was to maintain a constant cadence. They had to maintain above 60 revolutions per minute. So then after that 5 minute kind of warm up, so to speak, on the bike, what they did was they went into an incremental test where they increased the wattage 35 watts a minute. And they continued doing this until the individual either reached volitional exhaustion or until their cadence dropped off below 60 revolutions per minute for 5 seconds. And they could not b go back up. So, when we talk about it, using the clinical significance or implementing this in the clinic, because, very few people have the ability to measure a VO2 max. Like, you just don't have the means to do that. And so,
There's no great way of like guessing it or estimating it, really, fortunately.
Right. You have to have other metrics. And so like if you work with a cyclist or someone who has like a Wahoo kicker, like something like, or they have a power meter in their bike and they know either what their peak power is or their functional threshold power, whatever, that they will know that. And then you can kind of set training zones off of that. But the other thing is you have to get them to that endpoint, right? Because, you know, how do you know what a 4 out of 10 on an RPE scale is if you don't know what 10 is? And so I think that's an important point to make as well. And you can do this relatively quickly and easily. All you really need is a means of reliably measuring power on the bike. And so that's the thing that I would kind of say as well, when we start talking about RPEs and the feasibility of incorporating an RPE into the training, we have to kind of know what the max RPE is to get to that level.
Well, and that's why RPE is going to be a little bit more valuable in a trained individual, because they're going to be more familiar with like, what does it really truly feel like to exert yourself intensely?
And something that we haven't talked about yet from this paper is, you know, Kyle, like you had mentioned, as far as, you know, is this a relevant way to dose the exercise? Even with this trained group of individuals, dosing exercise based on maintaining that set power and doing BFR was too hard for one of these trained cyclists, and he actually dropped out. So, you know, this is, you know, bringing up the, okay, this might be the optimal way to get the most out of an exercise session, which we don't know that, and I'm not making that claim, but, you know, it still might be too hard as a way to start somebody when you're dosing your BFR exercise. So, you know, maybe if nothing else, the RPE model gives you a way to dose exercise and grade somebody into it, because, you know, they're going to self-regulate for something that they can maintain. They're going to, you know, adjust their revolutions per minute or the power or whatever that metric might be to make it something that fits into this RPE range. And then as they get more accustomed to it, the same amount of work is going to be a lower RPE, so they can ramp it up a bit. And maybe that gives us a way to grade into something like the endurance-based BFR, which we still don't have great information on how to do it at this point with, you know, what is our optimal pressure? What is our optimal power? Whatever that metric might be for how we're going to dose it, it's been a lot of experimenting with, you know, what do people tolerate, and how do we make this a useful exercise session?
And this paper really didn't help us sort any of that out.
No, it didn't. Either. It didn't give us a lot, yeah. But you know, and they did bring up that the fixed RPE with BFR looks like it's giving you something similar to that kind of control training at a set power while doing a lower workload, which is similar to what we see with other BFR papers. Okay, you're getting a similar thing with less total work when you're doing BFR. So then that, you know, at least kind of fits into what we already know.
And then just to clarify for everyone listening, when we say trained cyclists in this paper or trained individuals, because they use cyclists and triathletes, they provided their VO2 numbers. So their average age was 40 years old, and their VO2 max, relative VO2 max, was 52.8 plus or minus 3.6 milliliters per kilogram per minute, with a peak power of 372. So for anyone, you know, wondering what was categorized as quote unquote trained, those were the kind of means that of the subjects in the paper.
And they did. So I didn't pick up on this until you just said that, Zach, but they had a peak power of 372, you said. That's just kind of the average across the sample size.
That's right.
Then they really kind of didn't even individualize the power, the fixed power that each individual was working at, right? It sounds like they took the power that everybody worked at from their average number, I'm guessing. So they took like a percentage of that or something. How did they land on that 200 or 220?
I think they did it individualized because they have a standard deviation for that number of the set training power. It was 217 plus or minus 27. Yeah, so I think that's...
So not everybody trained at the same power. They trained at different... That was the mean.
But that was
the 20 plus the mean, okay.
That power was associated with the power at the first ventilatory threshold. So wherever that person's power was at for that first ventilatory threshold, and for, again, like you may think if you're listening, being like, hey, like how am I determining a ventilatory threshold? Well, because we don't have like med carts and stuff like that to do indirect calorimetry. That first ventilatory threshold is when the individual is unable to able to talk and complete sentences, but they're able to string words together. So they can still talk through the exercise. They're starting to, the respiration rates are starting to increase. The workload is starting to increase. It's starting to tax them a little bit, but they're still able to converse and communicate. And so at that point, like that's when they started to, or that's where they based the power off of. And then that's the mean power that was reported was at like 217.
I didn't hear. I didn't know if we were giving us. That's good. Cool. I forgot what I was going to ask next. What else you guys got?
That's about it. I mean, the other thing that we haven't talked about was lactate, which, you know, kind of seemed similar to what I would expect. You know, it was the highest in the BFR and set power group. Yep. And I tried to look back because they were talking about lactate correlating with like VO2 and respiratory rate pretty closely. I forget exactly what they were saying as far as
that was the difference, Ben. That was the change. So for that RPE group, mm-hmm. it was the change in power, which was BFR minus the control.
Mm-hmm.
That was significantly correlated with VO2, respiratory rate, and blood lactate. And the blood lactate was immediately post as well as 2 minutes post. So at each time point that they collected blood.
So higher lactate in the BFR groups compared to a control group, which is, again, kind of what we would expect to see. And the lactate, as we might expect, you know, correlated with the amount of discomfort with BFR as well. So kind of similar, and again, kind of fits what we would expect from the amount of awfulness that BFR endurance exercise creates.
And then I think the other thing that I would just add on the BFR with power, with constant power, was they utilized more oxygen during the test as well. So again, like it goes to you're working at a higher, you know, kind of quote unquote percentage.
So I think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, one of the things that we sort of see fleshed out here is kind of what often is going to take place in a clinic over time, right? If you're really doing BFR well, and this could be resistance exercise with blood flow restriction, it could be aerobic exercise with blood flow restriction, but you're going to probably underdose a little bit initially because the person's, they've got to tolerate it. If you want them to keep doing it, they have to, you know, and they may be totally unfamiliar with exercise. And so you need to kind of build that tolerance, which we know happens. And we see that happen over and over and again in the literature, whether it be RPE that we're looking at, or it be the tolerance to an 80% pressure, or just, you know, the ability to increase load over time. And so basically we have these people that are exposing themselves all in different time points, but ultimately it's like, all right, start here where people can handle it, and then working towards a more individualized dosage that is not based on how you're feeling, but based on what you're able to perform, if you will. Right? It's kind of where we're working towards in the grand scheme of things. Agreed?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, so that paper, for those of you listening, was in the journal, or the the European Journal of Sports Science. We'll have it in the show notes. I think that one was open access, and I can't quite remember. If it's not open access, just be sure to send Ben an email and ask for the full text. He'll be happy to send it your way. I'll put Ben's email in the show notes at the end.
I'll have my typical out of office telling people to reach
out to Kyle. That out of office goes to Kyle. So I'm getting it. Yeah, that worked. That doesn't always work either.
FYI, so.
Yeah. Zach, you want to tell us about this Thompson paper, this Jamie Burr paper?
Yeah. So moving into the next one, the title of this one, like Kyle mentioned at the very beginning, low and high volume blood flow restriction treadmill walking both improve maximal aerobic capacity independently of blood volume. The purpose of the paper was to determine if blood volume and its constituents, red blood cells, hemoglobin mass, and plasma volume are altered following BFR training of different frequencies, and whether these changes explain the observed improvements in VO2 max. A secondary aim was to determine whether the acute hormonal responses to BFR exercises altered following the training. What they hypothesized was that BFR training at both frequencies would increase VO2 max, and that this would be due to an increase in blood oxygen carrying capacity and blood volume. So basically going back to an increase in either red blood cells, hemoglobin, which would drive this change in VO2 max. What they did was they had individuals come in a parallel group, 28 folks. They used a protocol that we talk about in the course. It was from Park. And just briefly, what this protocol consisted of was walking at a speed of 5 kilometers per hour at a 5% grade. And they performed 5 intervals of 3 minutes walking with 1 minute rest. The tourniquets were inflated to 100% limb occlusion pressure. And they remained inflated during the rest period. Individuals just stand on the side of the treadmill during that rest. Outcome measures that were looked at was changing the VO2. This was assessed biweekly. And then hemoglobin mass, which was assessed, or lab draws were assessed at baseline and post-training. The conditions, we have a control group that's just literally going to walk on a treadmill 2 times a day, 5 days a week for 4 weeks. This translated to 37 sessions because whenever they did testing in the biweekly part, they missed a morning session. And then there was a BFR group that trained at the high volume. That was the same as the control group, treadmill walking 2 times a day, 5 days a week for 4 weeks. Again, 37 total sessions, cuff was inflated 100% LOP. Then we have a low volume BFR group. They walked on a treadmill 2 times a week for 6 weeks, total of 12 sessions with the same kind of cuff inflation protocol. Outcome measures that were looked at. This was really interesting because when they looked at VO2, they looked at VO2 in the context of single leg as well as double leg. And so single leg was performed at baseline and at the post training. Double leg was performed at baseline every 2 weeks and then again at the end. So when they tested both, so at baseline and then post training, single leg was tested first, then they waited 5 minutes, and then they tested the double leg. And so what the protocol consisted of for testing was single leg. They had a weight put on the other pedal to kind of offset that so it wouldn't feel awkward. And they did 2 3-minute stages, one at 100 watts and the second at 120 watts. Then they follow that up with a 20 watt increment in every minute until the individual is unable to maintain the cadence. And then double leg was the exact same protocol, just with both legs.
Yeah. One bit of clarification, and only because when I was reading this protocol, I was like, whoa, hang on a second. They used the park paper and they basically went 19 minutes at full occlusion. So I went back and
Nope.
read. They
It
actually deflated
deflated.
after the third set,
Yeah. Oh,
here,
they
which I
did.
don't
They
think
did.
Park
Yeah.
did. Because Park wasn't at full occlusion. They were using those little narrow Katsu bands.
Yeah.
So I read that, because they say we use the park, and I'm like, whoa, hold up. But they use 100%. That's
Yeah.
19 minutes full occlusion bilaterally. That's a long time. And
Yeah, I thought the
even
same
still, they
thing.
did seven, they did 15, 16, 17 minutes.
Well, yeah, I had to write it out to really look at it. So
I think you almost
you've
have to.
got 11 minutes at full occlusion with 3 3-minute walking rounds. Then you've got a minute
Yeah.
deflation, and then you've got the
That's
3 minutes, 1 minute, 3 minute. And
yeah.
so that
Not
still
11 minutes.
sounds,
Yeah,
yeah. So
11
the
minutes
11
straight.
minutes was the long period. Then you have a minute off, and then you've got 7 more minutes at full occlusion with, the 3 minute rounds of walking. And that's, I've been waiting for somebody to replicate the park walking study in some form or fashion, because the
Yeah.
results from that paper are pretty fantastic.
Right.
And so,
And the
this,
methods are pretty simple
yeah,
in
and this seems to give us some sort of replication of that, although it's, the 100% occlusion. I kind of want to try this before I go recommend it to anybody. And for those of us that are trying
Imagine
to figure
that.
out what 5 kilometers per hour is, because if you're like me, I'm like, well, okay, what is that in
It's two
miles
and a
per
half
hour? Because
miles.
that's,
Yeah.
yeah, well, it's right around 3 miles an hour. So it's, and that's pretty similar to what you would see in a self-selected walking pace if you let people just walk however, fast they want to. And Zach, I think you did say this, but it was at a 5% grade. So
Yeah.
that does, make
That's going
that
to
just
make
a
it.
little bit harder
Yeah.
to maintain.
The other,
And
I was just going to say real quick, the other thing with this too, because like sometimes people ask during the course about how they tested VO2 and whatnot. They did the walking trial. It was a walking protocol, but then they tested it off the bike, which is typically what that's typically what you're going to do. Is test VO2 off the bike. It's probably the easiest, unless you're going to have people run, but
Well, and we haven't really gotten into the effects on VO2 max in these training periods, but it was, essentially at the, 2 week mark. If you're doing it twice a day, then you've at the end of 2 weeks, you've got about an 8% increase in VO2 max in that group. If you do it 2 days a week, by the 4 week mark, they had a 9% increase in VO2 max, if I'm reading that study correctly. So that basically gives you the options of you could do high frequency for a short duration, or you could do a little lower frequency and a longer duration and get a pretty similar effect from that. So maybe it depends
I
on
mean,
which pedal you need.
twice a week walking is
Very doable.
very
Yeah.
doable, very easy to integrate into some sort of, training regimen. Kind of no matter what sport or activity you're involved in, I'd say that's relatively easy to
Yeah.
squeeze in there. Although
Yeah.
we do need to kind of confirm this 100%.
Yeah, I mean
Although
that's
I
the
have to say, like walking at 80% is
not that bad. Yeah.
not bad.
It's way better than the
It's very
bike.
doable. Way better than the bike. Well, way better than the bike.
Yeah, and I mean the only missing piece from this that we have in the park study compared to this one is the park study was on trained individuals. It was basketball players, where this one is more of the recreational individual. So you know, I'm not quite there yet to say that every basketball team on the planet should do a walking program in season, but you know, a couple more of these and you get a couple of, you know, recreations on trained individuals showing the same
I
thing.
mean,
It's like, okay, well,
Kentucky
why
might think
wouldn't
about
you?
it, don't you think?
Yeah.
The
Oh, did I go there? My bad.
the
My
one thing
bad.
that I would point out too is when you look at the results of the data, like Ben said, it was roughly the high volume group in the ballpark of 9% at 2 weeks. And then when they retested it, or they tested it at the end of 4 weeks, it was like 8%, something like that. But you look at that low volume group, they kind of plateau after 4 weeks. And so when you look at like what is optimal, well, here's the deal. Like you literally have people walk twice a week. Your results are hitting at the 4 week mark. And then those remaining 2 weeks of testing, it just kind of plateaus a little bit and you don't get really near the boost. So it looks like you can expect a change even in the low volume group at around the 4 week mark. So
Would
somewhat you would say if we're gonna just kind of say like where are the results coming in at high volume, you get it roughly at 2 weeks, and that's what Park showed as well. However, if you reduce the volume and make it much more clinically relevant, 2 times a week, it's at 4 weeks. And so it takes twice as long, 2 versus 4 weeks, but the results are pretty much the same with significantly fewer visits.
Well, and it begs the question of, you know, is that the time point where we're seeing a need to push the intensity to continue to see an effect, as opposed to, you know, to it's not any better if you continue to do it kind of thing.
And then the other part of the conclusion or the results of this, besides VO2 max, they didn't see any changes in blood markers. Hemoglobin didn't change. Red blood cells didn't change. Plasma volume didn't change. Hormones kind of fluctuated a little bit at the very beginning, but as the training went on, they actually either stayed the same or decreased. It was interesting because like I think this is one thing that we say like in a course when we talk about the aerobic side of things, you know, and it's like how do you determine VO2 max? We talk about, you know, there's this one equation, it's called the Fick's equation, and what that says is basically VO2 max is equal to your cardiac output times the arterial to venous O2 difference. Just boiling that down into layman's terms, you have a central component, which is your cardiac output, and then you have your peripheral po component, where it's basically how much of that oxygen are we able to extract out of the arterial side and create a larger deficit on the venous side. And so what Jamie and that group, you know, showed was there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of a central. There's a central component, but it was not like the overreaching factor, which they initially thought was one of their hypotheses. And so they go on then in the discussion to talk about, you know, a lot of the influences in VO2 could be explained from the peripheral component, whether that's a change in capillarity, so increasing perfusion to the exercising muscle, potentially maybe a mitochondrial change either in quantity or capacity. That's kind of the other aspect of the results as
And
well.
they felt like they felt like it'd be on the central side, if I recall, because you know prior studies have shown pretty large increases in heart rate, and then I think there was something to do with the blood volume as well that I didn't quite,
They
I
it was
never quite finished wrapping my head around, but.
they thought that they were going to see an increase in the hormonal aspect that would regulate blood volume. And so they thought they were going to see an increase in that would then drive just overall increased total amount of blood. But they did not see that.
So
And
yeah, so more blood means more oxygen you can pull out, that kind of thing.
like a change in red blood cells, all that stuff, but did not see that. And so they rejected that part of the hypothesis and you know, thought maybe the changes that we're seeing are you know, there's a good contributor from the periphery. And I think too, you know, that's one of the things that I tell people You know, if you're worried about VO2 when you ride the bike, because this is a really important thing to remember and consider with BFR, is all these studies are done cuffs worn bilaterally. And I think that potentially goes to a central component when you talk about the reduction in blood volume back to the heart, change in stroke volume, increase in heart rate, all that stuff. But then also too is you're going to get those peripheral changes in both legs. Whereas if you only do wear the cuff on one side, the quote unquote involved side, I don't think that you'll get quite the change in VO2, and that's actually, you know, what it showed. This paper showed as well when they looked at single leg VO2 changes compared to the double leg change.
I think another kind of interesting thing that we might be able to pull away from this is, you know, the BFR, excuse me, the high volume group, they did like three times the amount of sessions, right? And the results were basically the same, just 2 weeks apart. So it really kind of makes you wonder, how much more volume do you need to add to that low end group to actually really sort of get to where that high volume group is at? Like, it makes me think, I bet I could, we can peel away some volume and still get there, you know? So could you go instead of
Daily.
twice a day for 5 days? Yeah. Could you go daily? Could you go, you know, just a number of like a set number of times per week, that is maybe like, I don't know, six or, you know, 10 or something like that. That, well, 10 would be pretty in line with what they did, so they want to do that. But somewhere in there, it seems like you probably could, but like bump up that volume a little bit, and maybe see some changes a little bit quicker, and to the same magnitude, at least in that short duration. But then, of course, you know, I think we all are kind of on this page. Like, it really probably looks like, you know, especially based on the low volume group at that 4 week, at that 6 week mark, something needs to be adjusted to continue to see adaptation, right? We need to increase the intensity of what we're doing somehow. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool to see the 2 day a week model. And to me, 2 days a week, 4 weeks is a pretty, that's a pretty low volume of total work
Really
to get a
is.
substantial effect. And that's huge for us in filling in some gaps of the question on minimal effective dosing, right? And then the next question becomes, you know, is 100% occlusion necessary to see that? And that's
Yeah,
where,
right.
you know, we
Absolutely.
definitely,
Yeah.
yeah, we need
A good
more
point.
info on, you know, what is that pressure that needs to be there to really see this? You know, is that full occlusion potentially necessary there? You know, and even they did it in a somewhat intermittent, you know, they had that one deflation in the middle there, probably for tolerance purposes, I would assume. So then it's like, okay, well, if you do 80% and you keep it inflated, does that kind of do the same thing? You know, and so obviously more questions come from it, but it does give us something individualized for endurance exercise, which we need.
I think, and you know, to a bit of a clarification there too, like, and Zach made this point on an email recently, which I thought was good, because I feel like on occasion we're seeing from people that this idea that you can get all these changes that you want to see with exercise, but not having to endure the discomfort that the exercise induces. And that's you're going to have to deal with the discomfort of what you're doing at some point if you want it to create adaptation in tissue. Like, that, there is no getting away from that. Like,
You
it's just a
gotta.
matter of when. These folks did it at 100%, good on them. Can you do it at 80? Probably. You're still going to have to get just as uncomfortable as they did for the most part if you want to see the same kind of changes, though.
Right. And that was kind of something that we discussed a little bit off air beforehand, going back to the cycling paper. It's, you know, they talked about the fact that, you know, the fixed RPE group that was able to get something kind of similar with a, you know, a lower power output. So it's probably similar to a the control exercise session, and, you know, you're able to regulate some of your work for periodization purposes, things like that. I kind of view it in the opposite of, well, if I'm able to work at that fixed power and endure the discomfort of BFR for this really short 10-minute time frame, maybe I'm getting a training session that's similar to one of my longer training sessions, and there's some additional benefit there. You just have to embrace the additional discomfort, but you only have to do it for 10 minutes. It's a shorter period of time, and you're, you know, getting a bigger value from your, you know, really high amount of discomfort for that short time.
Yeah, man, you just gotta embrace the suck, man. It's what
Yeah, I thought Ben was gonna say that.
I
You
wanted,
know,
I wanted
embrace
to.
the suck, but you know what? Hey, the pleasure is in the process. You know what? You want the end result? Hey, put David Goggins on 10-minute reels. Dude, I mean, what else you got to do? Dude, Goggins will have you. Dude, you'll be like 220 watts. What's this, dude? Let's crank it up. Let's go 260, 270. Even if max watts is 370, I mean, we're doing it.
Yeah,
You
you haven't thrown up yet. Are you
know?
really
That's
training? Is
right.
this
That's right.
yeah. I mean, I haven't blown through all the cartilage in my knees, and my feet aren't bleeding yet. So I mean, I don't know that I'm really doing much
There's
here.
more. There's
That's
more to go.
right. I mean, yeah, Goggins will get you there. That's right. You know what?
Yeah,
Hey, you're
well,
like you're dehydrated. No, you're not. Lick your lips. Keep going. Let's go. I mean, come on.
it's just drink the bag. Just
I
drink the
mean,
IV bag. Yeah.
yeah.
No
Yeah.
need to put it in a vein. Just drink the salt
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess
water.
that's the next step. You have your IV bag hooked up to you while you're doing your
Yeah.
BFR on the bike, and you don't ever need to leave, right?
Hey,
Hey.
Danny Christensen is doing femoral blood draws while people are cycling. You know what? Yeah. Plus,
That's a
like multiple
Sounds
biopsies.
terrible.
I'm like, dude, man, this is intense.
These poor grad students can't
Yeah.
get out of doing these studies.
Who knows?
Yeah.
It could be the undergrads as well taking like an exercise physiology class, and it's like, dude, you're struggling here. You're not passing the test. Come on in, do the project.
That's some extra credit. I got some
Yeah,
extra
yeah,
credit for
yeah,
you.
yeah. We need participants, and you need a grade. So,
Let's make a deal. Oh no. Now we're gonna have to get Christensen on here so we can apologize
Oh
for Zach
man.
saying he tortures his
Man,
students.
dude, I mean yeah, man, dude, the multiple biopsies would be, man, that'd be tough.
We haven't talked about that paper, have we? Or
No,
if
but
we
it's
did,
good, you know. I mean, and that's the thing
it's
too.
just so dense is the
It
problem,
is.
man.
But
It's
you
so
know,
dense.
I think the thing of it is, depending on the population, man, his the one that he came out with recently about the ability to buffer hydrogen ions is going to be huge. The military, that is the deal. And if we can buffer hydrogens, maintain like pH within that fiber, dude, that's going to be the deal, with these guys. So
Embrace the suck. Where does that come from? Embrace the suck.
that's military stuff there, buddy.
Yeah, I
Well,
mean,
but who invented it?
that's a good
What,
question,
just
Kyle.
the military in general? Like, what's the
I mean,
origin? Do you know?
oh man,
I'm pretty sure I've seen it on t-shirts and bumper stickers
I
before.
would.
You know, I wanted the back of our shirt to say "Embrace the suck," but it sounded
So,
like "Earn Your Deflate" was more marketable, and
Black Rifle Coffee Company
not
gets the credit.
copywritten. That might have been another issue. So,
We'll say that it was the United States Marine Corps Reconnaissance Group,
somehow I knew it was
that
going to come back to
that's
Zach's group and doing
what
it.
we would say, and everyone else just stole it because it sounded so damn good. That's what the SEALs do. That's all the SEALs do, man. Is they just
they hijack it, and then they market it.
Zach,
look,
that's what they
do. I hear black helicopters outside your house right now, dude. Oh man, military.
Zach can only say that because he's from a department of the Navy. So
that happens to be the men's department, by the way.
Unreal.
I said that to a Navy guy in a course a little while ago, and I had like I don't think people got it, and I had to clarify like what that actually meant for the non-military people. But
funny.
Well, fellas, that was good. Anything like final thoughts on these papers? Final, just sort of over 30,000 foot view takeaways kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway, especially from the paper from Jamie Burr's group, is if you want this change in aerobic capacity, and it has to be fast, you have to increase the frequency. However, if you have a little bit longer of a duration that you want to see this change, you can significantly reduce the volume back. And it appears that like at 4 weeks is where the result will come in. It's going to be comparable to what you get with a higher volume in a shorter period of time. And then like we've all talked about, it appears after that 4 week mark, something has to change with your training. You know, you either have to increase the intensity, something has to change for that. And then, you know, with the first paper, you know, you can somewhat early on base your effort, so to speak, or what you're training at based off an RPE. But I think to kind of get those gains that you ideally want to see, you're going to have to objectively start to measure stuff and then base your training loads off of those objective measurements, whether that's a VO2 max, whether that's off power, whatever you're going to use. I would say those are probably the big takeaways.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a whole lot to add beyond what Zach already said. I think the interesting thing to me, and this is not the takeaway, but an interesting question is, you know, if you can get away with 2 days a week for your 4 weeks, you know, I wonder for that very high frequency group, would you start to see the changes earlier if it was measured earlier? You know, if you're looking at the same total number of sessions, you know, maybe end of that first week, early in the second week, are we starting to see that change for the similar total amount of work compared to that lower frequency group over that longer period of time? So
yeah, almost take like a midweek measurement rather than an end of week measurement. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and obviously that's hard to pull off because, you know, with the research, they do the testing in these different time periods because it's hard to get people in enough times to really look at all the things that you want. So, but that would be a really interesting question to try and answer.
If you follow their model, you just do it on Wednesday instead of Friday. Right. Yeah. You know, give you that time point. Although I think you also kind of have to go, all right, well, we are still talking about a study with what, 28 subjects.
Yeah.
You know, so not huge numbers. You almost kind of want to replicate that and make sure like that's really truly a thing, and kind of go from there. So
yep.
But with that said, Kyle, I'll if you cross reference that with the Park paper,
you get similar numbers.
Yeah,
you know, magnitude of change is pretty similar. So there's that. Yep. You're right about
there's
that.
There's what 11.5% out of the Park paper and 9% at 2 weeks. And so I mean that's definitely in the ballpark. And you're talking two completely different demographics of individuals too.
Well, and the Park paper is at what we assume a much lower percentage of occlusion.
Yeah,
because they're using the narrow, you know, kind of elastic style of cuff that isn't going to give you 100% LOP or anything close to it. So then that kind of adds to the question of how much pressure is really necessary to get these effects. So
for sure.
More questions for than sure. answers.
Always. Usual. That's always the deal, right? That's the standard conclusion of every research paper. More research is needed.
Yep.
All right, y'all. Well, thanks for joining us. Next time, we'll see if we decide to let Johnny back into the chat. Maybe we just don't send him the Zoom and we just do it ourselves. You know, at least he'll be like 12 pounds lighter next time you hear from him.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more of us talking when Johnny's not here. I realize that.
There's a lot more of us talking.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Feel better, Johnny, if you do ever listen to this, you know.
Yeah, that's the beauty. He doesn't. All right, y'all. Good job. Thank
all
you.
All right.
How do I stop this? Pop, stop. There we go.
Thanks for listening to the Owens Recovery Science Podcast. Owens Recovery Science is a single source for PTs, OTs, ATCs, DCs, MDs, and other medical professionals seeking certification in personalized blood flow restriction rehabilitation training. Find them online at owensrecoveryscience.com.
One last thing before we get out of here. First, want to say a sincere thank you for listening all the way through. But also wanted to remind you that this podcast should not be considered medical advice. It is strictly entertainment. It's a way for us to try to keep up with what is ongoing within the BFR world. If you require some sort of medical attention, medical advice, please seek that from a licensed individual within your state. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.